Some wars are won with a single decisive strike. Others are ground out inch by bloody inch. In Tacticus, victory belongs to those who endure. The Departamento Munitorum requires your services to deploy your forces in Tacticus, the ultimate Warhammer 40,000 mobile strategy game. Featuring adaptive tactical battles, a rewarding progression system, turn-based PvE and PvP battles, collaborative boss fights, and strategic calculations. You will command legendary warriors from the 40k galaxy, with each faction bringing its flavorful strengths and traits. Tacticus receives continual updates and new heroes, plus it delivers an ever-evolving battlefield through its limited time events, allowing you to unlock new units and reward you for the progression of your existing ones. Exploring the onslaught and salvage runs becomes essential to securing components and ensuring your squad strength is sufficient to progress. Timed events come every month, and progression is saved so that whenever the event returns, you can continue onward. This month, follow Lieutenant Titus with the Ultramarines and Blood Angels into the horror of a Tyranid invasion. Later on, in Sacred Uprising, it's the Genestealer Cults event. Tacticus is the perfect game to step into now, as you can take the grinding wars of the 41st millennium wherever you're travelling this summer. It's also now available on desktop. Don't forget to redeem my code LOOTINMARCH also for some in-game benefits. Click on the links below or use the QR code on screen now. And if you've never given it a shot, I recommend trying out Tacticus for free today. For the defenders of Rax, the coming months and years would bring down upon them more material than any could have imagined were possible. Many longed for any opportunity to lash out at the enemy, or to just see them at all. Such opportunities rarely came. They were forced to endure a blackened, ash-filled world, a barren wasteland of craters. Many were buried alive in their bunkers, which collapsed from the unending bombardments. From the outset, many began to wonder just what they had gotten themselves involved in at the behest of Cardinal Zafan, as the death toll slowly rose, day after day after day. Despite its infamous reputation, the Siege of Rax is and was, in fact, nothing extraordinary. When set against the vast apathetic machine of the Imperium of Man, Vrax was all but a routine operation, more bureaucratic than military. It was calculated, methodical, and grimly efficient. When Vrax Prime ceased responding to all communication, and the discovery of rogue Cardinal Zafan having effectively taken over the world, but was then subsequently trapped in place before being able to launch a system-wide campaign to bolster his own misguided entitlement to power, it could have appeared to be a devastating turn of events. In the grand calculus of the Imperium, though, such incidents were neither rare nor of particular significance. A failure in loyalty, a spark of heresy, or even just an overzealous display of autonomy was all within the purview of the Adeptus Terror and the Administratum, either of whom could bring down the hammer of Imperial Retribution, or allow it to be dealt with at a more local level. Thus the Adeptus Administratum issued orders relating to Vrax. The Departamento Munitorum enacted standard operating procedure to isolate the world, deploy Imperial forces best suited to the task at hand, and begin the long work of compliance through force. There were risks, of course, there always were, and whatever failures had occurred here in not earlier identifying the misguided agenda of the Cardinal would inevitably be investigated later, and many held accountable. But for now, an Imperial armory had been seized, and while not a critical incident, it was, for the Munitorum, certainly not an ideal situation, or one which could be ignored. The Siege of Rax was never intended to be a war of strategic innovation or cunning. The deployed regiments were not chosen for finesse or swift victories, but for their ability to endure and weather attrition. There was no scenario that made any practical sense upon Vrax other than a slow, grinding operation. It was in the context of the Imperial Administratum more an accounting exercise than a campaign. Casualties were calculated and losses accepted even before the Imperial Guard were notified of their deployment. Trenches would be dug, artillery placed, and the grey tide of Krieg's guardsmen would advance metre by metre, their lives traded for ground in a morbid economy of attrition. There was no need for grand strategy, no expectation of heroic manoeuvres, just the relentless press of Imperial will and material firepower. So it was powerfully fitting that beyond their practical capabilities, the soldiers of Krieg were faceless soldiers bred for obedience and sacrifice. Vrax was anticipated as being entirely standard, predictable, a war like so many thousands of others across the stars. It was paperwork upon the desk of an administratum scribe, another box to be ticked on a Munitorum data slate ledger. It was only after years of bloodshed that it would become something else, far more sinister, far less predictable. The straightforward operation that required no additional support, no specialists, no elite Imperial forces, would prove to be anything but. The prelude was nothing but silence. Then it was as if the planet itself screamed out in unbearable agony. The shells raining down upon the traitor enemy pulverized stone bodies, ignited ammunition dumps, and choked the entire enemy line with thick, dense smoke that suffocated any without breathing apparatus. It was hell. It was mechanical annihilation that marked not merely the start of an offensive, but the moment that saw the transformation of the title, Vrax, into a byword for industrialized slaughter. Earthshaker rounds, screaming bombard shells. It was a storm that lashed itself relentlessly against an enemy that had never anticipated such brutal ferocity. Earthworks, redoubts, and forward trenches ceased to be physical structures and became pitiful landscapes of churned mud, liquefied corpses, and fragmented ceramite. It is said that over the initial barrage alone, the planet's crust itself buckled under the fury. Seismographic readings registered minor tectonic shifts across the Vraxian surface, though whether from artillery or the will of the warp remains debated. The defenders, poorly trained in comparison to the Death Corps, acted out of rage and furious desperation more than any kind of disciplined plan. They attempted to return fire. Basilisk artillery was positioned in pre-prepared and theoretically pre-ranged firing positions. The Krieg, operating their own artillery without pause, could not even hear the incoming rounds over the cacophony of their own weapons. Yet many observed the rounds now fired by defenders were landing well short, others long, some even wide. It was clear to the Krieg that their enemy had little training and even less capability to be concerned about. Despite the time that they'd had to prepare for this inevitable war, they were somehow seemingly still poorly prepared. Inevitably, given the sheer weight of firepower being exchanged, some guns of the Krieg were still hit directly, killing all at their positions, sometimes even igniting stockpiled ammunition dumps in spectacularly massive detonations. But it was of little concern to the Krieg, who continued on with the task at hand, unmoved and unconcerned. In stark contrast to the defenders, to whom it was clear even by the first day that the Krieg had multiple significant advantages over their enemy. The Vraxian traitor forces remained largely entrenched behind their own fortifications, but they suffered in these initial stages horrifically. The triage stations and medical personnel were of varying standards, many struggled to cope with the vast range of injuries inflicted, some of which were significantly traumatic. The worst injuries were those from shrapnel, as in many instances as big as a man's fist or head, the resulting impact often tearing limbs from individuals. At other areas of triage, medics struggled to diagnose, let alone treat those suffering from wounds inflicted by overpressure. Lungs ruptured, sensory systems shattered, internal organs broken, sometimes near liquefied by the concussive forces unleashed. Yet within the ruins of their bastions, they still endured. They were fueled by fanaticism, not to mention the fact that it was clear to all that they were now fully committed to their cause, which was also Cardinal Zafan's. Their only hope for survival was to await some kind of opportunity, or a plan that would otherwise allow them to leave this place. They kept their faith, for they were as invested in this misadventure as was the Cardinal. From the Krieg perspective, this opening attack was just a flavour of what was to come. Strategically, the barrage achieved its aim, to render the no man's land into a hellscape so volatile that movement itself became an act of divine defiance. Very likely enemy morale was presumably already seeing cracks emerge, and when the guns finally fell silent, the only sound was the distant toll of trench alarms, and in the near future, the slow, deliberate march of the Death Corps. Their next action would be to advance through the smoke, flame, and the ruined remains of those who had fallen into craters so deep they were only accommodating of the dead. The traitors expected the worst to come immediately, but it never did. They had no idea what they should have expected, but for as brutal as the initial barrage was, somehow they had expected more. The Krieg had in fact been limited in their initial advance. There was no pressure nor desire to speed the process. The siege was being carried out as so many hundreds of others had before. The advancing Krieg merely moved forward to secure positions. They provided security. New trenches were beginning to be dug. The shelling of enemy lines continued unabated, preventing any meaningful response, so that by nightfall on the first day, the advanced Krieg had already dug some impressive foxholes, which would then be expanded into preliminary trench positions, and then later fortified. Each member of the Krieg knew exactly what they were doing, and they carried out their assignments in a pragmatic, unhurried fashion, even as the enemy were still recovering from the immense shock and trauma of the first day's bombardment. The Krieg expanded their positions. They strengthened them with sandbags and reinforcement. Razor wire was laid out and dug in. Heavy weapon teams were brought forward to cover the new front line. It was near to textbook for the Krieg, who had learned the methodical process over many years of service. But unlike other regiments, even the new recruits among the Death Corps were as efficient as their veterans. All knew the task at hand and carried it out efficiently. Over the coming weeks, the trenches grew ever more. They were expanded further back as well to make it easier to run lines of communications and logistics. And despite the time elapsed, the defending enemy made few significant attempts to even return fire. They were so heavily pinned down by the still unending Krieg bombardment that they cowered in their dugouts, unsure how to proceed. And while something of a defensive front line still remained, in many places whatever the leadership of the Citadel saw on their maps was now no longer representative of the reality on the ground. Nonetheless, and despite the lack of practical response by the traitors, their defensive positions were in fact still considerable. The Krieg had fully expected that the outermost lines surrounding the Citadel would be much easier to break, and that as they progressed inward, its secondary and tertiary lines of defence would inevitably be the ones to focus upon, the more challenging objectives. And paired with that was the expectation for them to deliver diminishing returns for every guardsman's life required to press the advance. But again, this was all expected. It had been anticipated even before they'd deployed to the surface of Vrax, and the leadership had approved every stage of the siege. But the Vraxian defenders had well anticipated this ongoing campaign. Consequently, they had relayed millions of mines, so that the attacking forces of the Imperium no longer knew where these were located. The references listed on older maps were useless, and this action undoubtedly bought them some time. By now, their defensive lines were less of a specific hard line and more like defensive zones punctuating areas. Many, though, still were connected through installations of ferrocrete and plasteel walls, pillboxes, and heavy bunkers. And although there was no specific hard front line, the traitors had improved these as best they could with rubble, general detritus, and enlarge their underground shelters for the defenders. All of this had to be hastily improvised. But the defenders' positions were still substantial, and while it was true that a single frontline didn't really exist, their defensive sectors provided well-equipped fields of fire that covered multiple areas and created intense kill zones for any advancing infantry. Often, all of this was connected with or supported by assets which ran miles deep. For the Krieg, advancing through all of this was to be no easy task, and while it was anticipated, it would still be costly. Vrax was always going to be a massacre. Victories were measured in crawling advances, not mass breakouts that seized miles at a time. The more momentum the Death Corps could maintain, though, the better. With the defenders having suffered in both morale and casualties, there was now to be no delay. The 149th Regiment were first to make an assault in a sector that was assigned an irrelevant numerical position. It could have been literally anywhere along the line for all that it mattered, but like everything else in this war, it all came down to arbitrarily assigned numbers thrown against one another. Now, I've often complained about the bizarre inconsistencies when it comes to the numbers of individuals involved in the wars of the Imperium, planetary assaults involving tens of thousands of soldiers. It's just ridiculous, and honestly baffling to understand why the numbers involved cannot be more reasonably estimated. Thankfully, and I think notably, in some of these older references, it is entirely more accurate. Nonetheless, though, the inconsistency remains rife throughout the storytelling of M41, and this is quite high on my can't sleep at night irritations. So it's soothing to know that in the first assault of the Death Corps of Krieg upon Vrax, they deployed multiple regiments, and remembering also what I've said recently about the use of the term regiments. So while the Death Corps of Krieg are a regiment, they're also organised into numerical sub-regiments. Anyway, their plan was pretty straightforward. A brutal assault of some 500,000 guardsmen. That's right, 500,000. Sounds more palatable for the opening engagement upon an Imperial arsenal world, doesn't it? They would drive forward in a massed infantry assault to then enable a cleared pathway for armoured assets. The plan was that these would then secure a forward area and everyone could dig in. The assault would come in several waves over 2 days, and while the first wave was expected to be effectively slaughtered, weak spots could be identified and specific positions could be targeted in the following waves. Heavy bombardment of the area to be attacked began, of course, in the days prior to the assault, and this would not cease during the initial wave advance. The infantry forces were to be supported by a complex artillery barrage plan. Firstly, mortars from the Krieg trench lines measured to strike directly into enemy trenches, suppressing and destroying as much harassing fire as possible. Then heavy mortars and quad launchers behind would pound the enemy heavy weapons as the guard advanced. Behind these were the Medusa siege guns targeting heavy bunker emplacements, along with the monstrous bombards which would support the rolling barrage and hit deeper positions behind enemy defences. A terrifying 4 million artillery shells had been brought up from their logistical stockpiles purely for this assault. For the defending traitors, who had already endured near to as much as they thought they could, there was no warning, no countdown, no signal beyond the thunderous ignition of thousands of siege guns engaging all at once. As the Death Corps of Krieg began their opening barrage, it was not a strategy, it was doctrine. A statement of intent, defiant punishment written in fire that cracked open the skies. The landscape ahead of the fortified bastion of traitor resistance ceased to exist in any comprehensible form. All physical defences were crumbling under direct hits, tank traps, dragon's teeth, all obliterated. Defensive razor wire, once snarled in great metallic webs, was vaporised or flung skyward in flaming coils. Concrete pillboxes braced for siege bombardments, they either endured or cracked open in immense explosions as they detonated from within by penetrating shells. Proximity impacts caused such massive shockwaves near to bunker firing ports that they turned confined spaces into abattoirs through the shrapnel and pressure unleashed. Any who came to look for survivors in the aftermath soon wished that they had not. Each shell unleashed was a gift from the Krieg Manufaktorums. Heavy weapon nests were zeroed by the Medusa high-impact charges and collapsed them into craters filled with fire and limbs. Bunkers were crushed by the Earthshaker rounds, which impacted with such force they shattered structural supports, pulping occupants with the sheer pressure unleashed. Comms links, Vox relays and command nodes were struck by precision shelling, severing lines of control, and what resistance remained did so blindly cut off, isolated. Even the ammunition stockpiles buried deep beneath ferrocrete layers were not spared. Siege drills and seismic targeting ensured their locations, and when they were detonated, the shockwaves registered across the planet's crust. With every passing minute, the landscape ahead became ever more obscured, along with the sun itself. Light had been reduced to a minimum, rendering the world into a twilight of ash and fire. Respirators were now essential for this scale of siege warfare, but even at a distance to where they were not required, harsh winds carried the taste of metal and carbon to those who had merely heard the assault. Vox chatter became unintelligible static, drowned in the percussion of constant impact. For the traitor forces of Vrax, there was no reprieve. Huddled in their trenches and redoubts, they were subjected to a punishment so absolute that some surrendered to madness even before the first Krieg boots crossed into no man's land. Entire companies were reduced to scattered limbs and molten armor fragments. Any identifying markers of individuals were just erased by the unrelenting gods of siege war. But now, the guns fell silent. The first squad scaled the trenches and stepped out onto a scorched plain of blackened earth, broken stone, twisted metal, and far out of their sight, charred remnants of the enemy. Yet despite the enemy defences being in tattered ruins, those who had survived now came forth. They took up their positions, they readied their heavy weapons, they sighted into the darkness of the wasteland before them. It was now an alien landscape. It resembled nothing that had existed before this moment in time. At first, the Vraxian defenders, still suffering from the after effects of the bombardment, couldn't be sure what they saw in the distance. Some imagined their eyesight was playing tricks on them. Blurry shapes moved through the darkness, vast clouds of dust and smoke, until one of them was sure they saw an advancing, semi-crouched figure, and all hell broke loose. The first Krieg wave had advanced to such proximity to the enemy lines that even they were not stupid enough to shell their own companies. Instead, they had to face the heavy bolter and stubber positions of the traitor enemy. They opened fire, roaring down overlapping fields of automatic fire, a significant number cutting straight through the forward ranks of Krieg. Those who followed behind pushed on, resolute, unmoved by the oncoming fire, and they made progress and fell. They advanced and fell. They dug in and pushed forward into the storm of fire, only made worse by the first impacting enemy artillery rounds, which by now had been accurately ranged and were absolutely pulverizing the rear advancing Death Corps. As the shelling intensified, even the Krieg were forced into taking whatever shelter they could within no man's land. And as the second wave began to crest their trench positions, many were immediately caught in the hellstorm of artillery and heavy weapon fire, falling back into their trenches or blasted from the positions before they even stepped foot onto the ground above. It was a miserable, horrific engagement, and entirely expected. Yet there was no panic, no screams, no fleeing guard whose morale was broken by the massacre taking place. The Krieg were, as always, stoic and silent. The wasteland between the two lines was now strewn with the remains of bodies awash with blood and fire. The first wave of Krieg were completely broken and in various states of retreat, advance, or buried amid the wounded. A few of the most persistent reached the enemy lines, though, and with fixed bayonets to the horror and shock of the defenders, proceeded to charge through them, hurling grenades and slaughtering without hesitation all that they encountered. But their numbers were few, and their glory short-lived. They drilled fear still into the enemy and made them pay a costly price for each of their lives. When all was said and done, the first wave had suffered typically no less than 90% casualties. But the second wave was now preparing for its duty to be done. If they felt any fear or hesitation, they didn't show it. The Death Corps operating best, without the entanglement of other Imperial regiments or the irritating presence of generic commissars. They silently lined up, ready to fight over the bodies of the dead and the ruined hellscape that awaited them. Second stage artillery now screamed over the skies ahead and could be heard impacting their targets within the enemy lines, hopefully reducing some of their heavy weapons. The Krieg clambered up and over and into the most horrific landscape imaginable. acrid rolling fields of black smoke, intermittent fires, broken, shattered remains of still-moving human forms, twisted webs of wire, pits so deep they're impossible to climb out from, and a maelstrom of incoming enemy fire that cut down many before they'd even advanced 20 meters. Mounds of dead guardsmen acted even as makeshift sandbags now, absorbing some of the incoming fire, even providing cover for the advancing second wave. Many of their number, though, were simply added to the mounds of the bloodied and shredded remains. They progressed as best they could, until nightfall, but still made no significant breakthrough to the enemy lines. Despite the apocalyptic scale of shelling and the immense number of individuals attempting to reach the line, many were now left out in the darkness amid the moaning piles of bodies and periodic mortar rounds which continued to land. Some among their number crawled through into the enemy lines and made their final stand with cold, inhuman ferocity. The screaming horror of close combat punctuated the night. But within the command headquarters of the Krieg defences, it was clear to all that the first assault upon the Vraxian line had been a disaster. They had failed to secure or even locate significant weak points. And despite the seemingly inexperienced nature of the traitors, the design and armament of the defences was seemingly so substantial, it was clearly going to take considerably more to achieve even minimal advancement. And more concerning was the fact that the Krieg had expected this to be certainly a costly first operation, but at least with the weight and scale of material thrown at the enemy, they should have been able to achieve some practical gain. They had in fact achieved little. And these were meant to be the softer front lines, which begged the question, what awaited them in the more heavily entrenched and defended secondary and tertiary lines, let alone the citadel itself, which was a sobering thought. Nonetheless, day two began, and to the genuine shock of the Krieg, who had returned as much as they could to their own line to consolidate their losses, they now found themselves facing an enemy counterattack. It was a bold and not entirely miscalculated gambit on behalf of the Vraxian defenders, who seemingly presumed that upon seeing the Death Corps take such heavy losses that they estimated this as their best possible time to strike. Unlike the Krieg, they advanced without any artillery fire, hoping to strike with surprise, which they did, but the ground of No Man's Land made for difficult advancement, especially given that unlike the Krieg, the traitors had attempted to cross using Chimera APCs. Heavy weapons fire engaged almost immediately, followed by precision artillery strikes. It was a bold effort, but the traitors were halted easily. Except not everywhere. At R4623892, Lieutenant Marrow and the survivors of three devastated Krieg platoons had consolidated together at the line, and as elsewhere they saw a mass of enemy infantry crossing toward them. Of course, they immediately opened fire. Marrow voxed for artillery support. For whatever reason, it never came. Their lasgun and heavy stubbers lashed against the enemy, but at this point in the Krieg line, their numbers were so depleted that they struggled to maintain a sufficient rate of attrition against the traitors. Soon they had close enough proximity that grenades were raining down into the Krieg trenches, setting off shockwaves and blasts that broke bodies and weapon positions alike. The trench was already lost as the traitors poured down into Marrow's line. They came screaming through the black and ashen smoke, their bodies wrapped in random patterns of stolen flak. Many of them already looked twisted by madness, some looked surely more like ghouls than men, others still wearing tattered remnants of their once revered Astra Militarum uniforms. Officer Moreau of the 143rd Krieg Siege Regiment stood unmoving, defiant, his las pistol hot in one hand, the other gripping his sabre. Most of his men were dead, buried or locked in close quarters, fighting all around him. As the first traitor dropped into the trench, Moreau shot him clean through the visor, a shower of blood hitting another, who followed immediately behind, and who proceeded to dive into the trench roaring with a rusting, juddering chainsword. Moreau met him blade to blade, teeth gritted, eyes expressionless, beneath the black lenses of his respirator mask. He parried once, twice, then drove his sabre into the heretic's gut. He twisted the blade, cutting upward until its spine gave way with a wet crack. Kicking them aside, the next was already upon him. He could hear several of his men being pinned and bludgeoned to death just within his peripheral vision. But Moreau now found himself facing a larger traitor. A sergeant by the markings worn, but these could have been easily scavenged. This one's eyes shone with an unnatural light, and before Moreau could even think to respond, the traitor brought his chainsaw down in a brutal arc. Moreau moved to block, but too slow. The blade bit deep into his left arm. He felt the visceral pain as its teeth chewed through flak flesh and bone in a heartbeat. His arm came free in a gout of arterial spray, his saber tumbling into the mud. Moreau staggered back, falling to one knee, and slumped to the blackened ash mud slurry which swallowed him halfway. Somehow, his pistol was gone. His lungs hissed through the cracked filter of his mask, and the traitor stepped in, ready to finish him. But Moreau was not done. Pulling free the last crack grenade from his belt, it primed as soon as he tore it loose.
"For the Emperor,"
he rasped in barely a whisper through the static of his respirator. The traitor saw it too late, as the trench junction they were fighting in vanished in a burst of white heat and concussive force. A spray of dirt, bone and armour fragments came raining down across the line. The surviving traitors pressed forward through the slaughter into the Krieg line, uncaring, unmoved, but immediately found themselves entangled with heavy resistance, being continuously chewed up by heavy automatic fire. They retreated. The Krieg response came swiftly. A new fire mission obliterated what remained of the frontline trench, smashing the enemy's singular foothold. As the first Earthshaker shells began to impact on the line, a charred service tag was lodged in the remains of half a respirator, still hissing faintly. The initial confrontation upon Vrax marked the beginning of a long period of stalemate between both sides, with the Vraxian defenders having expected much more thrown against them, and the Krieg somewhat incomprehensibly having underestimated the resilience of defenders with nothing left to lose. Night raids against enemy lines remained a continual fear, but achieved little other than brief moments of brutality and terror. Artillery continued to be the relentless killer. Each day saw thousands dead with little, if anything, to show for their sacrifice. Vrax was already a wasteland of a planet, but now it stood overcast with a permanent pall of ash and smoke that obscured most of the light from reaching the surface. A gloom descended over the world, the air thick with the stench of the dead who lay unburied, slowly liquefying in no man's land. The air, the ground, all water was poisoned with death. It was a grinding cycle of destruction, and in no time at all, a year had already passed, with no advances made by either side, no prospects even suitable for breakthrough assaults. The Death Corps had managed, though, to recoup most of its losses from the massacre of the first assault, and after 6 months of inactivity, an effort was finally made to make some kind of constructive breakthrough. Fort A453, an enemy strongpoint, was designated as the target. As was typical of enemy defences, it featured interlinking bunkers, pillboxes and underground quarters. Captain Tyborg of the 9th Company had been assigned this duty, and although previous assaults upon the strongpoint had been easily repelled, its artillery had been recently destroyed. The Krieg trenchline had dug an advancing forward position so that its attackers only had to cover some 300 yards to reach the enemy dugout. On the day of the assault, a preliminary bombardment prevented visibility and engagement by the enemy guns. The guardsmen stepped forth once more into no man's land. But after having covered only 100 yards, the Vraxian defenders' heavy bolters opened up, tearing through the advancing 9th. The Krieg crashed and rolled through the razor wire, pouring into enemy positions despite their already mounting losses. But even as they did so, mines were triggering and bodies and viscera were showering the Krieg as they pushed forward. The position had been left as a ploy for any would-be attackers, and the Death Corps had fallen into their trap. They were now faced with retreat through a minefield or pressing onward to the prepared positions of the enemy. Tyborg waved them on, pushing toward a pillbox that was already laying down heavy swaths of bolter fire. As the Krieg ran forward, the enemy began to emerge to respond to the assault, the casualties growing by the minute. But Tyborg had a foothold into the position, and they were not about to surrender it. Grenades slotted into the pillbox, pulping those inside. His troops were engaging the defenders at will. They had a chance. He discovered almost immediately that his Voxcaster, though, was dead. With no way to call for support, he sent instead a runner. The message was simple. 9th Company within wire, enemy growing in strength, will hold if reinforced. He had no way of knowing if the runner would reach their line or what actions would follow, but to simply sit here awaiting reinforcement invited their own end. So instead he pressed the attack. The Krieg now occupied the ruined ditches leading to the strongpoint and enemy trench lines. Some of his men were working toward the central bunker already. They captured along the way a personnel shelter, and Tyborg led them down into the darkness of the bunker to clear it out. But out of nowhere, las shots and bullets began ricocheting through the darkness. Krieg steel soon silenced the few defenders that were huddled in the dark. By now, like many of his men, Tyborg was already wounded, catching a stray shot from the last of the resistance. His already damaged helmet, though, saved his life. But then, a scream of incoming was heard somewhere far above. The traitors were calling in a strike on their own position. A few men made for the shelter, but only a handful survived the barrage, which hit dead on many of their positions at the surface. Below ground, Tyborg and some 40 guardsmen were all that survived. Trapped here, outnumbered, they were ready to make a final stand. But he and his men would fight a brutal underground struggle in the coming 24 hours. A battle in the pitch darkness, with only exploding grenades and weapons fired to illuminate the darkness. The enemy reinforced but could not break through to the gallery where Tyborg and his men continued to hold out. Often with their ammunition exhausted, they were forced to loot the dead traitors in order to continue holding the position. The struggle continued, the dead stacked to make defensive positions. The fighting was close range, physical, and without respirators none could have survived in such conditions. Unbeknownst to Tyborg, his runner had reached the Krieg lines. General Durgen saw the critical importance of the moment and launched a heavy bombardment behind the enemy line to suppress any reinforcement opportunities. Krieg engineers were dispatched immediately to break through and secure the foothold already gained by Tyborg, so that by the time he was making a final stand below the surface, reinforcing Kriegsmen had secured the strongpoint above and were attempting to break into clearing the underground positions. By the third day, the strongpoint was all but in the hands of the Death Corps, and all could see what this would mean for the upcoming battle for the first line of defence. The traitors retaliated furiously, but with a foothold gained, General Durgen was not about to allow this moment to pass, as had their humiliating first assault so many months previous. He tasked 3 companies of the 61st Tank Regiment, accompanied by a Baneblade, to press forward and make the position unrecoverable for the Vraxian defenders. The immense tank ditch that Tyborg had used to gain access to the position had to be filled in, though, for the tanks to progress forward, and the engineers supported by excavators managed to accomplish this while still engaged in active fire with the enemy. The tanks now having access, Durgen poured more men into the access point, the Death Corps making a furious assault that would see the position completely secured and rapidly reinforced. Tyborg, though, was still fighting their unrelenting underground war. The enemy had resorted to using promethium units to burn out the guardsmen. The stench of burning bodies, liquid fuel, and the nightmare jets of flame that burned through the darkness came ever closer. He and his men had nothing to respond to this with, and many were down to their last air filters. The prospect of asphyxiation in the darkness crept ever closer, but they struggled on, wounded, exhausted, and managing by chance to recover an intact flame unit. And this could make all the difference between survival and their extermination. The battle raged above. Tyborg and his men were suddenly aware, though, of a change. They could hear continual shattering detonations in the darkness that did not originate from above. A new force was fighting below ground, Krieg engineers. They were using demolition charges to blast the enemy from their positions, with fresh reinforcements able to crush the defenders in hours. Tyborg and his men nearly counted themselves among the traitor dead, with the engineer teams identifying them as friendly at the very last moment. Staggering out from the darkness, Tyborg emerged, wounded in just about every extremity, accompanied by a scant 8 surviving guardsmen. They were burned, blackened and ragged, their weapons all but empty, their efforts and those of the dead stood to be counted. They had achieved the first Krieg victory upon Vrax. With the position secured, the Death Corps pressured the advantage. Tanks and reinforcements poured in, heavy artillery bombardments were saturating the enemy in the surrounding area and limited their ability to counterattack. General Durgin was quick to maximise their advantage and pushed out from A453, forcing the Vraxian defenders to consolidate their positions and quickly build adaptive reinforcements. Guns had to be repositioned, and defenders simply needed to understand the fast-moving adaptive situation that was at hand, or risk being entirely overrun by aggressive Krieg companies who were pushing fast down the line. The breakout achieved far more than just one static defensive complex. The Krieg were advancing, and over the coming week, a raging battle was fought for every scrap of ground in the adjacent lines and the trenches directly behind A453. For a brief period, the miserable slaughter of trench war ceased, replaced by armoured units who pushed out across open ground. Any retreating enemy infantry caught unaware were slaughtered, static artillery was smashed or captured at range by targeted assaults, and although there were many miles of defensive line still as yet untouched, the Death Corps poured men and machinery into the breakthrough. Enemy units were abandoning their positions at an astonishing rate now, the morale broken, no longer able to fire wildly against advancing infantry in front of them. They were forced instead to deal with close-quarter trench battles or against armoured columns to which they had insufficient hardware to deal with. The panic and incoherence led to other positions along the line also breaking, and soon enough the Krieg were swarming forward in a full advance across no man's land, overwhelming enemy positions with ease, and a full retreat of the Vraxian defenders was now taking place all along the line as they attempted to withdraw as best they could to the secondary defensive line. The small but critical victory by Tyborg and his men had led to a full collapse of the Vraxian first line. It would mark the most significant turning point in the siege so far. Across the Merseland wastes, the enemy line was rapidly collapsing. The breakthrough had far more significant consequences than any could have anticipated, as the first break in the line meant that the Vraxian defenders were now unable to support their northern perimeter line, meaning that this also had to quickly fall back, and in so doing they lost a significant portion of their defensive line, including masses of assets, ammunition, and under the pressure of a full Krieg advance, lives. Yet this was, in all respects, not a morale break or a tactical error by the defenders, for had they remained and fought to the last, it's likely they would have simply been surrounded and obliterated. Nonetheless, losing the first line in the early years of the war had not been on their agenda. And while making their retreats, the defenders also showed some resilience, launching unexpected counterattacks against the advancing Death Corps, and made a capable showing of recovering their resources behind the next major line of defence. The Vrax defenders were once again throwing considerably proactive resistance against the advancing Krieg, and soon enough the seemingly unstoppable momentum of their advance had slowed significantly. Squadrons of enemy tanks and Chimera were being reported at the northernmost advance of the 19th Regiment. Tank bombardments by the traitors were collapsing trenches, burying entire squads. Packs of animalistic defenders hunted through the wasteland, descending upon any they could find and bludgeoning and carving them to death. And despite the advantage they'd held so strongly, Krieg units were somehow once again being overrun by these pitiful traitors. Artillery began to shell in massive barrages the ground between the first and second line, some Krieg even made to withdraw, often finding themselves caught too late by creeping artillery zeroing their positions. The Death Corps were forced to abandon their guns and firing positions. A new stage of the war had begun, and the defenders now more confidently repelled the advancing Death Corps regiments. Enemy tanks came fast, smashing through forward Krieg lines. At the northernmost position of the advance, the 19th Regiment were now overrun. Its commander, Colonel Adel, could do little else than watch the chaos unfold through the drifting smoke and dust. Sure enough, active reports confirmed it. Positions were falling and the advance was breaking. Adel committed his reserves and called for reinforcements. None were available. Yet the order from High Command was clear: hold the line with what you have. As the fighting raged to an intensity not experienced before, even by the likes of the Krieg, Adel considered how that simple description, to hold the line, would have been entirely unimaginable by so many ordinary civilians. Could even his commanders understand what this request truly meant? The horror required to achieve it, and for how long? By the close of day, artillery once more thundered from both sides, reducing whatever still existed of a traversable battlefield to a cratered quagmire of mud and flame. Some 19 quad launchers and mortar emplacements were lost. Many turned against the Krieg almost immediately after being captured by the traitors. By nightfall, the Krieg front had disintegrated. Trenches were no longer positions, they were killing grounds. Probing attacks came from all directions, and when dawn broke, the enemy renewed their assault, pushing from trench to trench. Colonel Adel led from the front personally now, repelling the first wave at the highly destabilized northern line. Their flanks were gone, surrounded by the traitors. Lieutenant Colonel Diner was killed when tank fire destroyed the 19th Command dugout. Adel's regiment were now whittled down to some 80 men, who were, including himself, entirely cut off. He ordered the wounded evacuated and split the survivors into two groups. One would break out and carry word of the breach, the other, his, would hold out for as long as possible. There was no illusion of rescue, this was their final stand. And they fought a truly hellish confrontation. They were making quite a fair show of things, until the traitors rolled forward a Hellhound flamethrower tank, which finally engulfed the command post in burning showers of promethium. Adel's body was never recovered, and with his death and the fall of the command post, the 19th Regiment ceased to function as a fighting force. Scattered pockets fought on, but the regiment was spent, equipment abandoned in the chaos of withdrawal. The collapse threatened the advancement of the entire front for the Death Corps. For as fast as it had been taken, the enemy were now pushing back with momentum that they had gained. Their counter-assault was delivering very tangible results, and the Krieg now stood facing the very real risk of a second humiliating defeat. Over the coming days, the 1st Line Corps scrambled to contain the breach. Elements of the 7th Tank Regiment and surviving Death Riders of the 19th were thrown into the path of the enemy to delay their advance. But even this wasn't enough to halt the assault. Orders went out for a general withdrawal. The 261st Regiment were ordered to anchor the flank and dig in. The most substantial damage, though, was already done. The enemy had seized the initiative, and Lord Zelka's campaign schedule was decimated. By the third day, which for many certainly felt more like the third week, saw the enemy tanks continue to push forward, and by now the threat of a secondary retreat had sobered the minds of the Krieg commanders. The 1st Corps was ready. Ready, that is, with some 52 Lehman Russ and Macarius tanks from the 7th who met the thrust. Outnumbered, the enemy still fought with a grim resolve to not allow their momentum to be wasted, and that at least they might slow the advancing Krieg, so that after three more days, the Death Corps counteroffensive had indeed been significantly blunted, but at a terrible cost for both sides. When the guns once again finally fell silent, and the last salvo of tank shells echoed into the smoke-hung distance, there was mere momentary silence, only to be shattered by the screaming explosions of burning metal, ruptured coolant lines, cooking ammunition, and fire which seemed to boil out of the husk remnants of Imperial armour. The battlefield had become a graveyard, yet where those earlier engagements had seen men thrown against material, now all that could be seen was a twisted plain of scorched steel stretching for kilometres. Limonros hulls lay half buried in cratered mud, their turrets blown clean off, tracks twisted like broken limbs. Macarius heavy tanks, once symbols of unyielding power, sat like gutted beasts, their interiors charred black, crew compartments turned into tombs. The enemy vehicles certainly fared no better. Vraxian battle tanks, many scavenged and jury-rigged, were frozen mid-advance, fused together in blasted formations where plasma rounds had chain-detonated their ammo racks. Several hellhounds incinerated spectacularly, leaving only skeletal chassis and rivers of still-burning promethium that pooled in shell holes like molten tar. Inevitably, in between the skeletal remains of the tanks, lay the dead. Krieg troopers, in their greatcoats sprawled in unnatural poses, charred by the inferno, frozen by the shocking intensity of the battle. Helmets and masks shattered, las rifles still clutched in lifeless hands. The Death Riders, whose charge had brought the First Corps precious time, were strewn amid their dying mounts, flesh and bionics tangled, sabers rusted in drying blood. Many remains were barely recognisable as human, reduced to blackened torsos and shredded strips of uniform. Others had been crushed beneath the treads, the ground itself churned into a slurry by the blind fury of machine war. The Death Corps field medicae worked without pause, tagging the salvageable, burning the rest. Scavenger servitors picked through the wreckage, removing data cores, ammunition and components not completely fused to slag. The Mechanicus here had already marked certain wrecks for recovery, most often not for repair, but for ritual reclamation. The 19th Regiment had been entirely decimated, taking with it some 80,000 men lost, killed, wounded, or captured, Colonel Addle among them. The enemy, bloodied but unbroken, now held ground that would take months at best to retake. Worse still, they were very obviously actively fortifying it. The next line would be even harder to breach, a fact that, as with every stage of the siege operation, had long been known as entirely inevitable, along with the expected cost demanded of the Death Corps. The battle for the second defensive line upon Vrax would be even more costly than had the first, and with this prospect in mind, the Death Corps of Krieg had already begun to replenish their losses.